That's the Booktown music, so it must be Booktown here on KVMR, and I must be Eric Tome, and I must be planning to be here for the next 54 minutes till 2 o'clock, talking with various people about various books and a couple of upcoming events in the Nevada County area. We actually have two main topics this afternoon. The first is about what it has felt like to be in Iraq over the past 4 years, well, 3+ some years, from January of 2003 to the middle of 2005, but with an afterword bringing it somewhat up to date. The book is by the Washington Post Middle Eastern correspondent, one of a trio of quite astounding reporters who've all had important books out in the last couple of months. Another one is Tom Ricks, who wrote the book Fiasco, and analyzing the military conduct of the war and the lack of planning. And the other one was Rajiv Chandrasekhar. I can't remember the exact title of his book, but it's about life in the Green Zone, something in the Emerald City, about what it's like in the Green Zone in contemporary Baghdad, where most of the American officials are totally isolated from what's going on in the country. We're fortunate that Anthony Shadid, who was the third of those correspondents, is an Arab American, speaks Arabic fluently, and developed friendships with a good number of Iraqis starting in, well, some of them he'd known before 2003, but he starts describing his encounters with them through 2003 into the end of 2004 and a little bit into 2005. The book is called Night Draws Near, Iraq's People and the Shadow of America's War. I talked to him earlier this morning, and I started right out asking about that title. You take the title of your book, Night Draws Near, from words to a popular Arabic song that you heard in Baghdad about 2 years ago, and then you subtitle it, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. Is Night Draws Near the Iraqi reaction to our invasion?
Yeah, I guess reaction might be the right word. You know, just kind of on the title itself, I was always struck by this idea of a sense of anticipation, of a sense of dread in a way. And I think that was one of the most powerful sentiments I felt, not only in Iraq during the invasion, but even in those months and years that followed. You know, what the book does try to explore is this idea in the most specific terms of what happened in Iraq after the Americans invaded and toppled the government. But I think in maybe a more general, in a general way, it's about how ordinary people deal with times that aren't ordinary. And that was, I guess, the ambition of the book.
And in the book, you return to the same people again and again from January of 2003, just 2 months before the invasion, to the fall of 2004, and then even a little bit in 2005. And their reactions changed quite drastically. Some people who welcomed the invasion come to hate it, and some people who were very skeptical about it begin to think it might be doing some good.
That's right. And I think that there was especially a Shiite psychiatrist who became a friend who I spent a lot of time with, and I thought his arc, or however we describe it, was one of the most dramatic. I mean, I remember standing with him in front of his home during the invasion. I remember being pretty scared, actually, and he's an older man, and he's gone through so much, and he wasn't even fazed by the explosions that were going on around us. But, you know, I remember him turning to me and saying, "Don't worry, it's almost over." And then I saw him a few days later after Saddam had fallen, and he was incredibly excited. He thought that Iraq was on the verge of becoming what the oil-rich countries in the Gulf look like. And it was sad to see how that changed over time, and it did change dramatically. And, you know, at this point, I was actually just trying to go find him in Baghdad when I was there last week. And he had left the country at this point. He's in Jordan, and his daughter told me that he was actually having heart trouble, that she blamed on just the stress and the difficulties he had to endure living in Baghdad over the past few years.
And you also record in many places the diary of a 14-year-old girl, well, she's 16 by the end of the book, who keeps asking again. She goes from being a supporter of Saddam Hussein to being much more independently minded, but she keeps asking again and again, why are they doing this to us? What have we done to deserve this?
That's right, and I in fact just saw her last week when I was in Baghdad. She's now 17, and you know, again, it's remarkable to watch her evolution because she is such a credible thinker. She doesn't fit into any easy categories, you know, against the Americans, for the Americans. She's really just trying to make sense of all this to herself. And I think that point that you just mentioned is a good one, and it's a powerful one, and it's one you can come across time and again in Baghdad. It's the sense of being on a big stage, you know, or Iraq, the country itself being on a big stage, and often people in Baghdad or in other parts of the country being kind of spectators who will play that they're not directing, that they're not acting in. They're actually just, you know, they're spectators. And I think she, you know, this young girl felt that time and again, that sense of watching these events take place around her and just trying to make sense of them because she wasn't necessarily part of them.
And for some of the older people, this was especially poignant because Baghdad had 30 years ago been apparently a wonderful place to live. You even title one of your chapters, I guess I'm saying this right, to Baghdada, is a sort of Baghdad attitude of sort of cockiness and we're on top of the world.
Exactly. It's a swagger almost. You know, and I think almost anyone you speak to who has been in Iraq all these years is going to point to the 1970s as kind of a golden age in a way. You know, Baghdad, you know, it had gone from this medieval glory when it was in some way the center of the world, centuries of decline, of being a backwater. And in the 1970s, you know, however brief that period was, you did see kind of a renaissance in the city. Oil prices had gone through the roof, and it allowed, money poured into Iraq. The country had pretty much the standard of living in Greece at that time. It was a golden age. You know, arts flourished, culture flourished. People were very optimistic. They saw the country is heading toward, you know, not only, developing status, but actually a developed country down the road. And, of course, that abruptly changed.
And it changed when Saddam Hussein came to power.
That's right. And, you know, soon after Saddam came to power, the war with Iran began. 8 years of just of carnage. And, you know, I think the best comparison to the war with Iran in the 80s was World War I to Europe. An entire generation was affected. The culture itself was militarized. There was a certain age, you know, certain, you know, men in their 40s, late 40s, early 50s, almost every one of those veterans that I meet have some kind of scar, be it emotional or physical. It definitely traumatizes a generation. I think in a way it traumatizes society, and it's one of those things that affected Iraq in such a deep way that we probably didn't understand before the invasion, that this was a country that in a lot of ways was shaped by that conflict.
And then again by the first Gulf War.
That's right, and the sanctions that followed, especially in the first Gulf War, devastated Iraq's infrastructure, and then it was followed by this decade of sanctions that wiped out the Iraqi middle class in a way. Taking together all these events, the war with Iran, sanctions, Saddam's rule, the first Gulf War, and you know, it brutalized the country, it traumatized the country in a very deep way, and that's the country we inherited. You know, we never inherited this country that I think some people had the notion of being a blank slate, that a new society and a new state was going to be built on. We actually inherited a country that was very deeply troubled, deeply scarred by the events that it had gone through over a couple of generations.
You're pretty careful in most of the book not to take sides in the question of what the American responsibility was, whether we went in deceitfully or not. But it's quite clear from the very beginning that the United States, there was nothing in Iraqi society that could have threatened the United States in any way.
I think that's true. I think the country, you know, Iraqis would always, people that I met there, that I have interviews with, would always make this point of almost being kind of bewildered when they would turn on the BBC Arabic, for instance, or watch a satellite news channel and see Iraq at the top of the news. And I'm talking about before the war. They couldn't really understand why so much attention was being given to a country that they themselves felt was crippled, was debilitated. And their own perception was very weak at that point, having gone through such difficulties over so many years. I think our perception of Iraq was far different than the perception that Iraqis themselves had of their own country.
And throughout the book, you throw in a number of Arabic phrases to describe particular attitudes. In addition to Baghdada, which was, I guess, inoperative by the time you got there, the one that you noticed the most was what you call, well, two of them, Gamid and Hanin.
Right. think those two words, and they speak a lot today even of what's going on. You know, the first one you mentioned is the idea of ambiguity or of not knowing, of something being inscrutable or unclear. People would use that term time and again to explain what was coming ahead. And again, like the title, Night Draws Near, this idea of anticipation, this idea of dread, of waiting for something to approach. I think that word also spoke to that in the sense of not knowing exactly what was going on, what, you know, that everything felt very very gray in a way, that there wasn't a lot of black and white. And the second word you mentioned, Hanin, I think is a very powerful word, not only in Iraq, but in the Arab world to a certain degree. And it kind of suggests a certain sense of longing, a certain sense of nostalgia. And I think it's most powerfully felt in Iraq because, like we were talking about a little bit earlier, this idea of the 1970s and that Renaissance, however brief, that a lot of people were witnessing, it's beyond God at this point. And it's kind of that nostalgia for that moment of hope, that moment that society, that life would be so much better. And there was so much optimism, maybe even a little bit of swagger that you hadn't seen in so long.
And after the invasion, it took a while for people to figure out what was going on, and then, but it didn't take too long. It was only a couple of months before at least two sides, the Sunnis and the Shia, began opposing the Americans and talking about the Italal, the occupation, in a way that I guess we wouldn't understand, but that to them, it was the same as the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Yeah. You know, it always struck me, as a reporter there, just these different notions of occupation, even how they sound in their respective languages. I think there was a sense that occupation, I think maybe for a lot of Americans, it might recall Germany or Japan after World War II, a somewhat benevolent experience that led to the rebuilding of these countries and their emergence, you know, 30, 40, 50 years later is some of the world's leading powers. In Arabic, the word is hasadab, like you mentioned, and it suggests very different images. I think for a lot of Iraqis, it suggests what the British represented after World War I when they conquered Iraq and defeated the Ottoman Empire. I think it also, like you said, speaks to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Not that these occupations were similar necessarily, or even remotely similar, but the notion itself and the word itself, you know, suggested a whole kind of historic memory, a whole sense of what they represented. And it's almost impossible to justify that term in Arabic, I think. I remember one official who became a friend, an American official, and his Arabic was very good. And he was speaking to tribesmen, and at one point he had to acknowledge, and the UN Nations at that point declared this such, he had to acknowledge that there was an occupation going on. And he told me he spent 30 minutes just dealing with like this unbelievable reaction from the people in the audience, denouncing it and arguing against it and angry about it. He thought it was a hopeless task in a way. And I think, you know, this is again one of the things that the ambitions of each side, the ambitions of the Americans, the desires, the hopes of Iraqis, didn't necessarily correspond. And I think as time wore on, they rarely intersected. You made a point that I think is a good one, the beginning of what you're saying, and that's that, you know, things didn't take shape so soon. You said a couple of months, and I think that's right. I think there was a sense of not knowing right after Saddam fell, not knowing what was going to happen, what the American intentions were. You know, when I look back at that time, you know, as being a reporter in those days and weeks right after the fall of Saddam, I always felt that, you know, that looting did go unchecked, that Baghdad was so scarred by what followed Saddam's fall, in a way permanently shaped the sentiments, the opinions, the sense that Iraqis had of what the war was about to ensue in their country at the hands of the American administration.
Now, you won a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting from Iraq, and a lot of that had to do with your excellent writing and your hard work, but I'm sure you're being an Arab American and speaking Arabic opened doors that other foreign reporters didn't have access to, and I get the impression that you understood the people in a way that nobody in Washington ever had any idea of how these people felt.
You know, it's hard to say what your background or language does, just because I've never done it otherwise. You know, I have used a translator in places where I don't speak the language, Iran or Turkey, for instance. And it's just so that you can do your job, and I think my colleagues have done been outstanding, really impressive and courageous work there. You know, I guess what, maybe I think it's more of a lesson about just reporting in general, and that's the more you talk to people, the more you listen, the more time you spend in conversations, I've always felt the better you know what's going on, the better able you are to write the stories about the situation. And, you know, I think back to the invasion, and I had to go back through all my stories as I was writing Night Draws Near, and I look back to what were the stories that held up the best over time, and they were always the stories that were as intertwined as possible with the conversations I was having with people. And in other words, the times in the stories that I might have said something that I felt rather than what other people were feeling, or I wrote something that wasn't necessarily really ground, you know, really tied up into the conversations I was having, that was often when I made mistakes and when I got it wrong. The stories that held up over time were the ones that were just the voices of other people.
You mentioned your colleagues in the Washington Post, and they've actually, three of you have written books that have gotten quite a lot of attention, and I'll look at the war from a different point of view. Thomas Ricks, who was embedded with the U.S. military, has recently written the book Fiasco, in which he writes about how everything went wrong in military planning. And I can't remember his first name, Chandrasekhar, who is, I guess, the bureau chief, has written about life in the Green Zone and how little the people who live there now know what's going on outside. With three reporters who could see so much, I'm surprised that the Washington Post was initially strongly in favor of the war.
You know, there's no question that mistakes were made before the war. I'm very proud of what followed the war. I think, you know, that my colleagues there really did, like you mentioned, Tom Ricks and Rajiv Chandrasekharan did an outstanding work there. You know, the Post editorial page is completely separate from the reporting side of the newspaper. We actually don't ever talk to each other, don't have much to do with each other. And I'm not even sure what their position is now at this point, but it's a credit to the newspaper that we do have such independence, that we, you know, editors, you know, rely on their people on the ground to have their sense of what the story is and where the story is headed. You know, I appreciate that independence. The reason I'm still at the paper is that, you know, I've never felt pressure or intimidated or anything like that by any means. Opposite, in a certain way.
To get back to what was actually happening, in the few months after the occupation began, after the war, you say there was a transformation, that Iraq may have been the last country in the Arab world to have a transformation from a sort of secular nationalism to a strongly religious nationalism, and that this happened with a speed that nobody who had known the Saddam regime would have expected.
Right, that's exactly right. I think it's a transformation that we're seeing in different degrees elsewhere in the region, but here in Iraq we saw these things take place in weeks and months, you know, processes that might take place over years in another country, and it was breathtaking to watch it happen so quickly. I was in Baghdad recently, and I was, at one point I was trying to make sense of what was going on. I was just standing in the same square where Saddam's statue had fallen back in 2003. Back in 2003, it was very easy to understand what that square represented. Saddam's statue falling, you know, represented the end of the regime in a way. A year later, when there was so much fighting going on back in 2004, you thought that the square represented an occupation in a way. And I remember sitting there last week trying to make what does it speak to today? What's the word that we can use, you know, to describe Baghdad or Iraq at this point? And I kept going back to the idea that so many of these forces that were unleashed by the invasion, these forces of a growing sectarianism, of a growing role of religion and politics that once were secular and more nationalist, of a government, you know, ceding authority in a way to different groups on a local level. I mean, you're having a collapse of authority in a way, you're seeing groups grow up in different towns, different regions that are taking power. You know, these forces that were first unleashed in 2003, basically, at this point, have kind of shaped the country and defined the country today. Forces that have gained so much momentum over these years that it's almost impossible to dent them or deflect them. And I think that's why so many people are kind of throw their hands up at this point to know how to go forward, because these forces are defining the country and there's little that can be done at this point about changing them.
In the book, the main Iraqi political figure is Muqtada al-Sadr, the very young Shiite clergyman who was opposed to the Americans from the very beginning. The other main force at that time was Muhammad Ali al-Sistani, who had been the person who actually forced the Americans to hold elections and took a strong political role, but was always nonviolent. As violence has grown, Sistani has said he won't have anything more to do with politics. Does that leave it? Is there a vacuum now that only Sadr can fill?
You know, it's interesting. That vacuum is being filled by a lot of people, mainly militias, and I think militias is always kind of a nice way of saying guys with guns, which is basically what they are. But when we talk about kind of the national landscape, I think you're exactly right. I think at this point, Sadr is probably the key political figure in our country, and he has a close standing to Sistani at this point, not in terms of religious authority. I mean, Sistani still is paramount in that, but in terms of political power, street power, of determining the direction of the political process goes, Sadr is probably the key figure in a way. And it's a remarkable rise, you know, from someone who, when I first met him and wrote about him in Night Grows Near right after the fall of Saddam, was a somewhat quiet guy, kind of insecure, unsure of his own authority and legitimacy, and now he is kind of a kingmaker in a way.
And is that something we should feel optimistic about? I have the feeling rather not.
You know, what makes me most pessimistic about it right now is that I think Sadr has lost control of his organization to a certain degree. Not completely by any means, but there are militias operating in Basra, for instance, and other parts of southern Iraq, even in Baghdad, who claim to work in his name and clearly don't. They work in his name, but they're pretty much independent at this point, doing what they want. They tend toward the criminal, toward the brutal. They're involved in some of these massacres going on right now. And so I think Sadr himself maybe is less of a threat than this kind of dispersal of power, this sense of groups rising up all over the country that are doing basically what they want, irrespective of what the government intends. And that seems to be the biggest danger at this point for the future.
So is there going to be civil war, or is the country going to split in three?
Yeah, again, I go back to that sense I had of standing in Photo Square last week, and, you know, we're thinking that civil war in some ways felt almost too tidy a term, too easy of a way to understand what was going on. It feels like there is elements of a civil war when we talk about the Sunni on Shiite violence. There's also so much more. You know, there's this kind of gangland style battle between groups that are often the same sect, they're often Shia on Shiite or Sunni on Sunni. There's a collapse of social services, a government that doesn't have a lot of authority. There's still an American presence in a raging insurgency that led to the casualties we saw in October. It is a civil war in one sense, and it's also a lot more than that in another sense.
It could be that Iraq was held together by a strong man, more or less the way Yugoslavia was, and that when Tito died or Saddam was overthrown, all the harmony that had seemed to exist is just exploding.
I think that's right. I think that's one of the saddest, you know, features of Iraqi life today is that, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, to ask somebody whether they were Sunni or Shiite was a very insulting question. You just didn't ask them that. There was so much intermarriage between Sunnis and Shiites. There was coexistence in neighborhoods of Baghdad among them. And I was struck so much on this most recent trip is how much that sectarian suspicion and in its worst form of sectarian hatred has come to kind of dominate life, define life in a way in the country. It is in terms of the intensity of it today, it is a new thing in Iraqi life. And it doesn't bode well for the future.
So are you going to be going back, or are you mostly reporting from other areas now?
You know, I've been reporting a lot from other areas lately. My office is in Beirut. That's where I live in Lebanon. But, you know, you've established so many relationships over time, over these years in Iraq, that I don't think I would ever be able to say goodbye to those people. And that was one of the main reasons to go back this most recent time, was to see how everybody was doing, to keep those friendships and those relationships alive.
That was an interview I taped, or CD'd a couple of hours ago with Anthony Shadid, who was the Iraq, one of the Baghdad correspondents for the Washington Post. As he said, he's now stationed in Beirut. His book, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, has just come out in paperback from Picador. Picador USA. He'll be appearing at Black Oak Books in Berkeley this Wednesday, November 1st at 8 p.m. And those were cats you heard in the background. That was an experiment of recording at home, and I should let you know that you may be able to let sleeping dogs lie, but letting sleeping cats lie is a little more iffy. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 o'clock, and specifically I'll be back in about 2 minutes to talk with David Callahan about his book, The Moral Center. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM, Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 o'clock. Earlier in the hour, we talked about the dire situation in Iraq. Right now, we're going to talk about the, in some ways, equally dire situation in the United States, where we've reached a level of polarization that I don't think we may have encountered since the Civil War. There's a new book out by David Callahan, who is one of the founders of the Policy Center Demos and earlier author of The Cheating Culture. This book is called The Moral Center, How We Can Reclaim Our Country from Diehard Extremists, Rogue Corporations, Hollywood Hacks, and Pretend Patriots. Welcome to Booktown, David. Are you there? There, sorry, are you there now?
Yes, I am.
When I first started reading your book, I was quite attracted by the first specific item you get down to, which is family values, because it's frustrated me for the last 15 years that Republican politicians and Republican administrations have talked again and again and again about how important family values are, and then have done so much to destroy family structure by preventing keeping low minimum wages, preventing parental leaves, preventing sex education, doing many things that would actually make families healthier, and instead have forced families to struggle in a very uncertain moral and economic climate. And you think the same thing.
Well, it's more than frustrating, as you say. It's outrageous that this level of hypocrisy goes unchallenged. I mean, here you have a situation where working families in the United States have come under incredible economic pressures over the past 30 years. I mean, the good old days of the one paycheck family, where you could have the American dream and a middle class lifestyle on one paycheck, are over. The single biggest change affecting families in the past few decades has been the need for two parents to be in the workforce in order to have that American dream. And that has subjected the family to huge amounts of strain. I mean, if you talk to parents, the main thing they talk about when you ask them about the family is the pressures of around time and money, and not being able to spend enough time with their kids or, you know, their spouse. And that all has to do with the economic changes in this country. And yet, you never hear that from the very same politicians who claim to be pro-family. And on the contrary, those politicians have systematically blocked one initiative after the other that would make life easier for families, whether it's the universal health insurance plan put forth by Bill Clinton that was torpedoed, or whether it's efforts to increase paid family leave time so that parents can spend time with their kids, or plans for affordable child care. I mean, you name it, the so-called pro-family politicians have been against it.
And you say that most Americans, there is a real moral crisis in this country, but it's not the moral crisis about abortion or gay rights or prayer in schools that is normally put forth by conservative forces, but more a struggle between the people you say care for their fellow citizens and those who do not care.
Well, exactly. You know, if you look at the polls, when pollsters ask Americans how they feel about the values of this country, a lot of Americans, 81% in the most recent poll, think that the values of this country are headed in the wrong direction. I mean, an overwhelming majority of Americans, both left, right, and center, think the values of this country are headed in the wrong direction. But when pollsters ask, well, what are you concerned about specifically, people don't list abortion or gay marriage or school prayer as their number one concerns. They talk about other things, a wide variety of other things. They talk about the pressures on family life generally. They talk about the decline of integrity and honesty, both in corporate America and in everyday life. You know, they talk about the millions of people who don't have health insurance, the millions of people who live in poverty. They talk about all the junk that's on television. So people have a wide array of concerns, and it is unfortunate that we've seen this anxiety manipulated and channeled very narrowly to for political gain by the right wing.
One of the other things that first attracted me to the book was a blurb by George Lakoff on the back. I very much admire his moral politics that really defines the sort of family structure that leads to either what you might call reactionary or progressive political and moral stands. But he phrases his solution to this is that the right wing has gotten a monopoly on framing discourse, and that progressives have to learn how to frame it better themselves. I think your approach is much more subtle and sophisticated, because you're really talking about not just framing a few words, but really discussing what's going on.
Well, I think that George Lakoff gets to the heart of the matter when he says that, you know, there are Americans who really take a strict father morality towards values issues. You know, they believe in punishment and discipline, in contrast to the kind of nurturant parent morality that liberals espouse. And I think that that's a major contribution to our thinking about values. But, you know, the important point Lakoff makes is that most Americans combine both ways of thinking. You know, and I make the same point, which is to say that we want people to behave with more self-discipline and show self-restraint. And, you know, we want there to be consequences when you don't behave well. On the other hand, we want to take care of each other and look out for each other and, you know, talk to ordinary people, and they believe both those things at the same time. And what I see is neither political party that really speaks to those beliefs. The Republican Party has, you know, been called the daddy party, and the Democrats are sort of stereotyped as the mommy party. You know, the Republicans are kind of the tough party focused on personal responsibility, and the Democrats are seen as nurturing and permissive and indulgent, and there's some truth to all of that. And so what I'm trying to do with my book is really espouse a vision for dealing with some of our social problems that would combine both those models. And I really, in contrast to Lakoff, flesh it out with ideas, you know, regarding when it comes to the family or when it comes to sexuality or the media or work and poverty.
Exactly, because I think Lakoff's attitude is sort of, well, politics is irrational. People vote because of stereotypes, and there's no way around that. And that has always depressed me. I find that there must be some way you can be reasonable and persuasive, and I think you've done a pretty good job.
Yeah, and, you know, ultimately this stuff isn't rocket science, but I do think that people need to come out of their crouched positions. You know, I mean, I've been a liberal my entire life and care as much as anybody about the core principles that progressives and liberals have fought for over the past 100 years, whether it is economic justice and a fairer economy, or whether it's civil rights or reproductive rights. However, you know, I think that both liberals and conservatives need to admit that there are problems with their respective visions. I mean, I think that we liberals need to acknowledge that the social freedoms we've won over the past 50 years, mainly since the 60s, have some dangerous downsides that we really need to manage. And I think that the Republicans need to acknowledge what's obvious to everybody, which is that the free market economy creates a lot of hardship unless it's offset by active government that protects people from the free market. And you know, neither side wants to give any ground. And and I think that if liberals and progressives can kind of be a little more flexible, I think that we can really create a majority. And I'm not talking about tacking to the political center. I'm talking about really redefining the way we talk about values and creating a moral center.
You mentioned at one point that one of the reasons that traditional values have floundered over the last 100 years, it hasn't been a matter of changes that took place, say, just in the 60s, but that as Americans have become more affluent, they've been less dependent on family, church, and so on, and they've been freer to experiment on their own, and that this is probably not irreversible. On the other hand, you point out that they're under more economic pressure than ever, so that they may not want to go back to those, most people might not want to go back to those traditional values, but they still, the affluence has not really made people comfortable.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is that, look, traditional values aren't coming back, right? The restraints that used to exist on human behavior, such as strict religious dogma, they're gone. And I mean, they're not completely gone, but they're largely gone. And they're gone for reasons that go deep to what's changed in the economy. I mean, if you look at the family, that the way in which we need a family in order to survive is just changed dramatically. You don't actually have to be in a family today to survive economically. And that poses some big questions for us. Like, how do we get people to buy into the notion of selfless obligation to others? How do we get people to stick with their commitments to in their marriages or to their children? And I don't think that the answer that conservatives offer, which is more a return to traditional values, is really realistic at this point.
And also the laissez-faire policies that Republicans tend to promote go in the exact opposite,
right.
Since they destroy restraint, they destroy self-responsibility in many cases, because they just offer take as much as you can.
Right, and a lot of the social policies are similar. I mean, you have the conservatives preaching abstinence-only sex education, which is no sex until marriage. Now, I mean, that might have been something that you could get away with pushing back in 1950, but the majority of Americans don't get married until they're in their mid-20s today. Right. So, and there's reasons for that, right? Everybody goes to college increasingly. You know, often you need to go to graduate school after college. People don't want to make a marital commitment when they're undergoing all those transitions. So that, I mean, that's a fundamental change in our economy. And I think it's pretty unrealistic to expect people to abstain from sex from, you know, the time they're an adolescent when their hormones start raging till the time they're in their mid-20s. And yet that is what the Christian right has been preaching through these abstinence-only sex education policies, which are not backed up by any research whatsoever. And yet 30% of our school districts now teach abstinence-only as the sole form of sex education, which is insane.
You point out that most other industrialized countries, European ones in particular, have managed to come up with rational ways of dealing with the economic changes, with the fact that we're lone individuals rather than families or farmers the way we were 100 years ago, but that the U.S. hasn't been able to.
Right. I mean, the United States has the harshest form of capitalism in the world, yet we've done the littlest to protect families or teach people to be responsible when it comes to sexuality. I mean, we have a media that's working 24/7 to fire up our libido. And in Germany, they have, in other European countries, they have really sophisticated sex education efforts that teach people to be responsible. German teenagers have abortions at 8 times lower rate than American teenagers do. That's because they have smart social policy in places like Germany and the Netherlands, whereas we're kind of kowtowing to puritanical biblical morality.
And the same way that the states in the U.S. that have the abstinence-only policies have higher abortion rates than the ones that have comprehensive sex education.
Right. The countries, and if you look internationally, the countries in the world with the highest abortion rates are those countries where abortion is illegal. And the countries with the lowest abortion rates are those countries where abortion is covered by national health insurance. So, what we find again and again is a conservative religious movement which is just disconnected from reality, but they get as far as they do in large part, I think, because they're tapping into a very strong anxiety that Americans have, that there is no bottom line, that our culture is on this sort of downward spiral, and that it's a moral free-for-all. And the Christian right comes along and says, look, we have some answers here. We're going to restore the bottom line. We're going to turn around the culture. And that's pretty appealing, even if you don't actually agree with the fine print about Scalia controlling your private life.
You have about, well, let's see, 8 chapters in all, 7 of which go into very specific subjects. We've been sort of caught on family matters and sex and responsibility, but you go on to discuss the media, and you say that Tipper Gore was right.
I do discuss the media, and I make the point that, look, if you talk to nearly anybody on the left and the right, it seems like everybody agrees that the stuff that's in the media is pretty disturbing. You know, people have different concerns, right? That the religious puritanical types are more worried about the sex, and liberals are more worried about the violence and the materialistic messages. But everybody's pretty concerned about this. Yet today, there's only really one political party who is saying, "Look, we got to change the media, and we got to clean up what our kids are being raised on," and that is the Republicans. And the Democrats have been pretty silent on this issue. And the reason for that, I think, is besides the kind of, you know, worries about getting on a slippery slope whereby the First Amendment would be undermined and, you know, free speech concerns, Hollywood and the entertainment companies are giving a huge amount of money to the Democratic Party. I mean, the Democrats get more money from the entertainment corporations like Viacom and Disney than the Republicans get from the gun lobby, than the Republicans get from the banking industry, or that the Republicans get from the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, the money from the entertainment company is some of the most powerful money in politics, and that money speaks.
In your various chapters, you give suggestions for particular problems like the media, or for crime and punishment, or honoring work and so on, helping the poor. But toward the end, you do say that what is really required is a change of consciousness, that government programs will only work to a certain degree, but that as long as we have this obsession with individual amassing of as much as you can get, we're going to stay this way and things may get worse. How can we get around that?
Well, I think that that this country's culture is pretty malleable. I mean, it has changed again and again. We go through these periods of greed and hard-heartedness towards the poor, and you know, these moments where it's kind of every man for himself and social Darwinism is strong. And then we go through these other periods where the idealistic, more egalitarian part of the American psyche becomes more pronounced. You can look all the way back in American history and see these cycles, you know, sort of periods of greed and excess followed by periods of reform and idealism. And I think that we're going to have a backlash to the 80s and 90s, the last 25 years, just like we've had a backlash to all the other go-go periods. And in my mind, the question is not when, but not whether, but when.
I assume that you wrote this, you actually completed the book sometime between 6 and 12 months ago. Do things look different now than they did when you sent it to the publisher?
Well, it looks like the backlash is likely to happen a little sooner than I thought, with the Democrats slated to take over the House of Representatives. I mean, that seems to be the conventional wisdom. Whether that will come to bear, who knows? But it seems as though there's already some real kind of pushback gaining steam to the kind of Republican Party policies of recent years. And it's not just the war in Iraq, but also the cronyism and the corruption of our politics by private money.
The question is, will the Democrats do any better? Nancy Pelosi has announced her plans for the first 100 hours, but will she really be able to push them through, and are they enough?
Well, I think that they're a good start. Let me put it that way. I think that the Democrats still need to develop a compelling moral vision. And the Democrats, of course, are also playing in a political system saturated by money, which corrupts everybody in politics these days. But I do think that they can change the tone of politics, and hopefully they'll realize that they really need to focus in on these values issues. You know, you can think of politics as really being three baskets of issues these days. There's the national security issues, there's the economic issues, and then there's the values debate. And the values debate, you know, gets into some of those other areas, but it is a sort of own sphere. And the Democrats have not really been competing in one of the three major spheres of politics, and I think they need to.
Okay, thanks very much, David Callahan, for talking with us. David is the author of The Moral Center, How We Can Reclaim Our Country from Diehard Extremists, Rogue Corporations, Hollywood Hacks, and Pretend Patriots.
Great to be with you.
Okay. This has been Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tone. Before I leave, just a couple of things I should mention. As you may have heard before, the Second City is coming to town. The Chicago-based improv comedy group is going to be here Saturday, November 4th with two shows at 6 and 9 p.m. This is a fundraiser for the Nevada Theater. So if you want to know more about this, call 265-6692. And another event that's happening, therapist and author Bill Larson will be at the Off-Center stage at 2 p.m. on Saturday, November 11th. He's going to be reading his piece, The New Vietnam, about a trip he took to Vietnam in 1996. This is collected in an anthology called Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace, that was edited by Maxine Hong Kingston and has just been published by Koa Books. So that's it's 2 p.m. Saturday, the 11th of November, at the Off-Center stage in Grass Valley. This has been Booktown. Stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.